Coming up on this episode of DL Weekly, Magic Band Plus is soft launching this week. Paper tickets may be going away. The Matterhorn returns with some updates.
Indy isn't getting the refurb we had hoped for. A lot of price increases across the board. We talk with former Imagineer Mel McGowan and more. DL Weekly starts now.
Well, hello there. Welcome to our unbirthday party. For your safety, please be sure to stay listening with your hands, arms, feet, and ears inside the podcast. And please, do give Peg and Teresa easier trivia questions. Well, it seems DL Weekly is about to begin. Have a most wonderful time. Perhaps tea time.
Well, hello and welcome to this episode of DL Weekly for the week of October 19th, 2022. I'm Teg Bushman.
And I'm Teresa Urban. We would like to thank all of our weekly tiers, including Gretchen D., Eric J., Brooklyn D., and Alex W. for supporting the show. Without your support, DL Weekly would not be possible. Your support ensures the podcast will continue and that we can make it to the parks more often to bring you the latest news and information straight from the parks. If you would like to become an official weekly tier, head on over to dealweekly.net/support to sign up.
Well, it's that time again for our friend Eric over at Concierge to catch us up on other Disney news.
Hello, everyone. This is Eric Johnson with Concierge, and welcome to the D180. While Teg and Teresa cover all things Disneyland, in the D180, we take a spin around the rest of the Disney universe, and we do it in 180 seconds. Let's jump right in. We start our journey this week in Walt Disney World, where we have our list of narrators. That's right. We Disney World folks like to do it big. Unlike the smallish ceremony at Disneyland, Epcot guests get to enjoy the candlelight processional from November 25th all the way through December 30th. This holiday celebration resembles the Disneyland version in many ways. It started out in the Magic Kingdom from the resort's opening. Rock Hudson narrated the very first event in 1971 and reprised his role many other years. It wasn't until 1994 that the event made its move to Epcot. From there, the event added even more nights to accommodate demand. This year, we have plenty of favorites returning. Edward James Olmos, Angela Bassett, and Neil Patrick Harris are always around for the holidays. We also get to see some new folks this year. Simu Liu, Shang-Chi himself, joins the cast. So do Gloria Estefan and Mariska Hargitay. Somehow, Josh Gad has never done one of these, but this year he finally joins up from December 10th through the 12th. If you're in town around this time, make it a point to see the candlelight processional. If you purchase a dining package at most of Epcot's many restaurants, you get priority seating. Make sure you're ready for those reservations 60 days out. Why not take a trip to Disney World to see for yourself? Most nights from December 11th to December 25th, a stay at a Disney resort is on sale. In case you're wondering, the narrators during this time frame are Josh Gad, Gloria Estefan, NPH, Mariska Hargitay, Cal Ripken Jr., and Marie Osmond. Guests at resorts like Animal Kingdom Lodge, Coronado Springs, and the Yacht Club Resort get 20% off of their stay. Rooms at Port Orleans and Art of Animation are discounted 15%, and the rest of the resorts on property are discounted 10%. Treat yourself to a holiday trip. Your concierge planners are ready to help you. I get it. You're not ready for the winter holidays yet. It's still the spooky season after all. Let's head to the Disney Wish to look at their Halloween revels. The Grand Hall aboard the ship is packed with pumpkins and foliage. Every Disney ship sports a pumpkin tree in the Grand Hall, and the Wish is no exception. In keeping with the ship's Cinderella theme, this tree grew pumpkins depicting scenes and characters from the classic film. Guests aboard during this season can expect costume parties, trick-or-treating, and plenty of chilling movies in their rooms or by the pool at night. Characters abound at any of Disney's Halloween events, so be sure to look out for both villains and villain-alikes. Rumor has it that Clarabelle Cow, Daisy Duck, and Minnie Mouse masquerade as the Sanderson sisters from Hocus Pocus. And that's 180 seconds. I hope you enjoyed our quick spin around the rest of the Disney universe. If you would like to learn more about these Disney adventures or just have a few questions, please come on over. Visit the social media and websites of both DL Weekly and us, their official travel planners, concierge. We look forward to planning something special for you and yours. I'm Eric Johnson, and this has been your D180.
Well, thanks, Eric.
Just wanted to make an announcement for everyone. The live stream scheduled for this weekend is actually having a slight date change. Instead of happening on Sunday, the public live stream, as well as a supporter hangout, will be this weekend on Saturday, October 22nd at 2:30 p.m. Disneyland time for the hangout for supporters and 3:20 p.m. for our public live stream. You won't want to miss this. We're going to be tuning in from a very magical place.
Oh, you're not even going to tell them where we're going?
I'm going to tease it. You got to tune in to find out.
Oh, it's worth it, guys. We were, just so you know, we were planning to go to Disneyland this weekend.
Yes,
there's
not
a Disneyana event.
We won't be at Disneyland.
We won't be at Disneyland, but we will be somewhere very Disney-centric that's not Disneyland. So I think it's
excited.
A really unique experience. Therese and I have not been to this place before, so it's going to be very exciting. So definitely tune in this weekend. Now let's get to the news.
Starting the day this podcast goes live, Magic Band Plus will start rolling out with a soft opening for Magic Key holders, DVC members, as well as some cast members. Other guests will be able to purchase and use the service starting on October 26th. Magic Band Plus will add glow-with-the-show elements during nighttime spectaculars, fireworks, and more. Admission to the parks will also work, as well as Genie Plus reservation redemptions at the attractions. The best news is that Magic Band Plus can be used at Disneyland and Walt Disney World, with no need to buy separate bands for each resort.
That's awesome,
because
concern about that. I am very excited. I feel like it felt like Magic Band Plus was coming like forever away, and all of a sudden it's here already for Magic Key holders and DVC members and some cast members. However, one interesting kind of loophole potentially here is they won't sell the bands at Disneyland to anybody except for people in those groups. However, it seems to me like if you had a Magic Band Plus from Disney World, you probably could link it to your Disney account
it. I don't know how that works, because you can buy Magic Band Plus on Shop Disney right now.
Yeah.
So
I just don't think
I'm not sure how that works.
The blog post from the Disney Parks blog made it sound like you would need to prove that you are one of these people to buy the band. But the use of the service, there's no way for them to like police that. You just add that stuff to your...
It's linked to your account, so unless they can somehow...
Well, you just buy the band, and then you link the band to your account. Like, there's no way that they track the band with the person until you link it to your account in the app. Because it works kind of like the old Magic Bands do, where there's like a little number on there, you add it in.
Yep, I understand. I guess I don't understand what you're saying.
What I'm saying is...
I understand that, but I don't understand what the loophole is.
The loophole is... If you have a Magic Band Plus from Disney World or maybe Shop Disney, you could start using this and not be a Magic Key holder or DVC member potentially. So I don't know. I'm just very excited.
Yeah, since it's linked to your account, maybe there's a way that they can say, nope, you are not a Magic Key holder or a DVC person.
Potentially.
So it doesn't. Anyways, we're going down
a rabbit hole with that one.
Weird rabbit hole.
But I'm excited.
I'm happy that it's coming. The one thing I am a little sad about is there is a special Magic Key holder, Magic Band Plus, that is available to purchase in person only. And there's, I think, what is it? There like a $10 discount on this Magic Band for Magic Key holders. I was talking with the Weekly Tier about this earlier. This is going to be a very difficult thing for me. I'm really bad at making decisions, especially when it comes to things Disney related. So this would have been an easy decision for me. I would have bought the Magic Key holder band solely because of the discount. It looks cute too. It's not, you know, it's not amazing, but it's not terrible. But then my decision would have been over. I would have gotten a discount. I would have a Magic Band. Good to go. But we're not going to be there, sadly, so we're not going to be able to purchase one of these.
Mm-hmm.
So now I'm going to be paralyzed with the decision of trying to choose which Magic Band Plus I'm going to get. There's so many options.
I'm telling you right now that for me, it's going to be a situation like the pins. If I see a design I like, I'm buying it.
Because
you can link a bunch of these and you can unlink them and relink
them and
stuff.
I know, but they're more expensive. The ones that are themed, I think, are $40. Let me look
somewhere
that up
$30, $35, something like that. I'm just really excited that this is finally coming to Disneyland, and it's not just Disney World.
So the Magic Band Pluses that are just plain, they just have, you know, whatever, it's a color. Those are $34.99. If they have some sort of print on them, so like this one I'm looking at Shop Disney right now has Orange Bird on it, or this one is up themed, those are $44.99. So it's $45 for the themed ones. So I'm going to have to be careful. You don't want to buy too many of those.
Epcot ones are $54.
Yeah, and then some of them, there's one that's Tiana themed, that's $59.99. That's on Shop Disney right now. Coco Magic Cocoa Band Plus. Cool. It's very cool, but it's $54.99. So this can get really spendy really, really fast. So me, one. I'm good with one. I don't need multiples because that's too pricey, in my opinion, to get multiples. So I'll probably end up with one of the plain ones because then all I have to do is focus on color. I don't have to try and focus on Disney characters. But it's going to be a hard choice. I was curious, are you going to get a Magic Band right away, or are you going to wait to see if they come out? Because right at Disney World, there's an app that you can get for your Apple Watch that turns your Apple Watch into the Magic Band.
No, I like the Magic Bands a lot. Yep. There's so many cool designs that I like, and I never understood why we didn't have these at Disney, because I think they're going to sell crazy amounts of these things. But even though they're a little more expensive than the original Magic Band.
The thing that I wish that the original Magic Bands, I wish we had the option, because I don't need to glow with the show and have it vibrating and lighting up and all that stuff. I just want it for the convenience. So I wish I could get and use just my regular Magic Band that I have from our last trip to Walt Disney World, just for the ease of scanning and stuff. I do like that these are rechargeable. That is a pro.
Yeah.
But as far as the extra bells and whistles, I don't necessarily need that. Now, will I go check out the new Star Wars Bounty Hunter game?
Oh, yeah.
Yes, because I can. But is that something I absolutely need to do? Would I have bought a Magic Band just to experience that? No, that's not my thing.
Sure. But I love this Epcot one, by the way, but it's $55. So I don't know if I $55 love this one. But anyway.
They're pricey.
I don't know. This Magic Key one looks kind of interesting. There was that one that was on display at D23 that was like a Disneyland one. This one.
Yep. The one that they've been showing for a while. Yeah. I haven't actually seen that available to purchase. That might be one that you can only purchase at the resort. Soon.
I'm excited that the service is coming. That's really what. Oh, the Korean says there's going to be 5 Disneyland exclusive designs. Well, I'm sure that they'll keep coming out with different things. So, with Magic Band Plus soft launching this week, more and more guests are using their phones or, in the future, their Magic Band Plus to enter the parks. Cast members at Disneyland have reported that physical paper tickets may be phased out for most guests. For guests that want a paper ticket, one can be provided for an additional fee. Again, nothing from Disney officially, but I can buy that this is probably happening.
Is it weird? This makes me very sad. There's something. I loved the paper Fast Pass tickets. I love.
Because they were a souvenir.
Yes. And I love. And it was so fun and exciting to get, you know, the first day of your visit to get one of those paper park tickets. And they always handed it to you upside down with the back facing you. So as soon as you like walk through the turnstile, what was the first thing everyone did? They'd flip it over and see what design you got. So that was always fun. Those were things that I always kept. Like I have my ticket from my very first park visit, Disneyland park visit ever. Yeah. I still have that. They had specially themed ones when Vern and I went for Pixar Fest, you know, and they changed the stuff up. I always hoped for the castle one if it was the classic rotation of stuff. Anyways, so this just makes me sad that paper tickets are not going to be. Well, I understand, but it still makes me sad.
It's one of those things that was like so easy to put in like a photo album or like a scrapbook of like, oh, that I still sometimes will be digging through stuff and I'll find things. And Fast Pass tickets was a good one. Yeah. Parking passes that you'd stick on your dashboard and tickets were a way to kind of commemorate like, oh, yeah, I did have that trip during this time frame. Because now what do you have? You don't have any other than like photos. You don't have anything to show when you were at Disneyland.
That's true.
So that's kind of sad.
That's true. The one thing, too, that is, and I said this when we got our Magic Keys, and Magic Keys were 100% digital. I like also having the comfort of having the physical backup so that if something happens with my phone or if I have something happens somehow with my Magic Band and my phone, I still have the physical ticket just in case.
Yeah, we got to get over
maybe
that.
Maybe that's just me, but
yep.
I'm going to miss them if this is true. Well, this past Friday, the icy peaks of the Matterhorn were once again alive with the screams of guests enjoying the bobsled run after its refurbishment. New seat cushions and refreshed effects are noticeable throughout. Harold, the Abominable Snowman, was completely refurbished and the projection effects were replaced.
So I'm glad I'm curious to see what the projection effects look like, because one of the things that I always found difficult is it's so bright outside when you're going on it during the day, mm-hmm. and you go up that first lift hill and it's so dark that it's hard to kind of see the projections because your eyes are still adjusting. But I'm very excited that Harold got some love.
Yay.
The seat cushions, I heard, people are always going to complain that it's too rough. I just kind of am over it. What did we decide? Didn't we decide that there was where you sat mattered?
The two sides too. I think the Fantasyland side is smoother than the Tomorrowland side.
Okay.
That could just be me. Definitely the back, you get whipped around way more in the back seat than you do in the front seat.
Sure. Yeah. I'm excited that it's back open. It's one of my favorite attractions. It mm-hmm. always just seems like it's there's a long wait, it always
but
seems
you know
like.
What's nice, though, is it is really nice to me. I was talking with someone about this earlier, but it's really nice that they do take the time to put this one down for an extended refurb frequently, and that it keeps getting all the TLC that it needs and deserves. I wish we're going to get into this next one, but I wish they did that with other attractions, because I feel like we have quite a few other attractions that are really needing and showing that they need some TLC and extra TLC, mm-hmm. and they're kind of almost limping along in some stages, and it makes me sad. So it's always as much as it's not fun to not be able to go on your favorite attraction because it's down for refurbishment, I'm always really happy, glad, thankful, whatever you want to say, that they do take the time to take care of these classics.
If you love it, you got to let it take care of itself at sometimes. Well, speaking of an attraction that we love and need some TLC, we previously reported that the Indiana Jones Adventure was going down for refurbishment with hopes that it would be an extensive one. Alas, the refurbishment will be a short one of only 2 days. Mice Chat reports that there were some fixes on the way, but the supply chain delays are what is holding up progress to getting a more extensive refurbishment.
This poor attraction. Poor Indy. The poor snake. I mean, I could go on and on about all the different major things, the noticeable things that haven't been working on this attraction for some time. But this attraction is one of the ones I'm talking about that really, really deserves and really needs to have an extended refurb to to give it the TLC it deserves to kind of bring it back to its former glory. I was really sad. I was hoping we were going to get this with Pirates, which I don't know.
They're still struggling.
But it was down for quite a while. So I thought that we were going to get a lot of the kinks and a lot of the effects and things working again. But it seemed like the last time we wrote it, it was still lacking on some of the things. Yeah. But
yeah, some of the far turntable was missing. And I think that the stuff that they really worked on was the actual mechanisms that move you through the attraction, because it seemed like that worked a lot better.
Yeah.
It just seemed like the show elements were the things that they maybe struggled a little bit with that.
Yeah. And then the other one, too, that kind of sticks out in my mind right now is Radiator Springs Racers is needed in some extra TLC, too. So, like I said, we all love these attractions, and these attractions get worked to the bone. So I hope that they're able to get it. And maybe I was talking about, I don't remember who I was talking about this with, but I'm hopeful that once Mickey and Minnie's Runaway Railway opens next year, that's going to be the new big draw. That's another big e-ticket type attraction. Mm-hmm. So adding one of those to the roster will hopefully give them a little bit more
breathing room
to be able to take these other big e-ticket type attractions down for a longer, more extended period. So I'm hopeful.
The problem with Radiator Springs Racers is you just need another attraction to draw people to
for
DCA. NDCA.
Yeah. I'm hopeful for Indy having an extended refurb. Yeah. I'm hopeful for another extended refurb for Pirates because of Mickey and Minnie's Runaway Railway. But
did you see, we didn't put it in the news, did you see that there is actual work happening on the treehouse? Like there's work people
putting
the branches back together.
Yep, and it looked like there was someone had thought that there was possibly new or refreshed leaves that had
it
been
did look
installed.
That way.
And it's getting it. See? TLC, that's what we're talking about.
I'm really excited to see what eventually comes of that.
Mm-hmm. Well, the holiday season at Disneyland is quickly approaching from November 11th through January 8th. Disney Festival of the Holidays is returning with Tina and the Sounds of Celebration, bringing powerhouse vocals and dynamic musicians to perform holiday tunes. Mariachi Divas, Mostly Kosher, Blue 13 Dance Company, Fat Cat Swingers, and the Mistletoes are all returning. World of Color, Season of Light, A Christmas Fantasy Parade, and Believe in Holiday Magic are also back.
Yeah, so great. Another, you know, the holidays, busy time, lots of cool entertainment.
Oh, it's so fun.
We actually got to see last year Mostly Kosher perform. They were pretty good.
They were a ton of fun. We kept trying to catch the Fat Cat Swingers, and we kept just missing them, unfortunately. Yeah. But we did get to see the Blue 13 Dance Company. They were super fun. Mm-hmm. And the Mariachi Divas as well.
I feel like we've seen the Mariachi Divas a few times. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I'm glad that a lot of these things are back. Excited that Season of Light is coming back for World of Color. Believe in Color, the Christmas Furniture Parade. And Believe in Holiday Magic are coming back. There was a rumor that Mice Chat was reporting, but they've corrected, that they thought that during the weekdays, we would just be projections only for Believe, but they have corrected that, that it is going to go during the busy season, even during the weekdays. So
that makes sense.
And apparently, I did not know this, so we thought, of course, in our way, that the reason they weren't doing fireworks during the weekdays was, like, money. Like, it costs a lot of money to put on a fireworks show. Mice Chat reports that the reason that it was there is they're trying to be a better neighbor to people that have kids that have school the next day. They're trying to not have that amount of noise pollution going on. So that makes sense. They wouldn't do it on the weekends, but they would on or on the weekdays, but they would do it on Friday, Saturday, Sunday. So that's pretty cool. I like the fact that that could be a reason that Disney is just trying to be a good neighbor. More locations are returning to use with the busy holiday season approaching. The Tiny Shop Embarcadero reopened in the last week. The shop is home to popular apparel, ear headbands, and jewelry. The merchandise mix is mostly princess themed and not limited to Little Mermaid as it was in the past.
So this is a really, really cool shop, and it's probably one that a lot of people don't even necessarily realize is there unless you visited it. But this is located in DCA, and it's right across from the entrance of the Little Mermaid attraction. So you've got if you're standing at the coffee shop, the coffee cart, the Joffrey's Coffee, the cappuccino
cart. Leave it to you to make,
of course,
that's the landmark.
That's the landmark. So if you're standing there and looking at the Little Mermaid attraction, it's on your left, across the street, what is this really cute little corner building, and that's the shop that we're talking about. So again, it's not very large inside, but it is kind of upscale feeling, sure. I guess would be a good way of saying it. It doesn't give you like, here's just all our generic like Disney merchandise that has stuff. Yes, there is that stuff, but you can find lounge flies, kind of like the nicer ears, the fancier jewelry stuff, not just the you know, like the jewelry that's in that they keep in the case, not just the ones that are on like the spinners. So things like your Alex and Annie jewelry, again, like I said, lounge flies, those kind of like the fancier merchandise is here. But it's a nice little shop.
I think there's only one time I've ever been in this building, and it was, oh gosh, this is going to be a throwback for some of you folks. I want to say it was 2002, and they had one of the promotions that DCA had was the X Games came to DCA, and this was an X Games shop.
Oh.
And I've literally not ever been in this building since then. So I'm excited to go check it out next time we're there, because it's a little cute little space right there.
Yep.
And that section is weird because half of those buildings is where the bathrooms are housed in.
Yeah.
And then the other, like, they're like these facades nothing.
And there's like, backstagey kind of stuff.
Yeah. So I'm excited they're using it for some shop.
A recent feature in the Disneyland app has some new Haunted Mansion themes. Magic key holders have exclusive access to these lenses, which are like filters that you can find in Snapchat. Guests use the Disneyland app and select the menu in the bottom right of the screen, then select Disney Photo Pass Lenses. This will show all the options. A Genie Plus subscription is required to use the lenses. The three Haunted Mansion lenses are a Screaming Woman, a Medusa-looking creature, and Constance Hathaway. So the Medusa-looking creature, as they describe in this article, it looks like one of the portraits, like one of the portraits in the hallway there. So
I was sad because it comes up in the app, and then I tap on it. It won't even show you like a demo. Yeah. It says that you have to get Genie Plus to do it, and then you can share. But I was looking through here because I honestly never went in here.
There are a lot in here, and I think they have some free ones, some that don't require you to have the Genie Plus subscription. Maybe I'm.
Oh, and this one, you have to be in certain areas of the park. See, like, mm-hmm. I've never mm-hmm. played with this at all. I didn't even. Did you know all of this was in here? You probably did. We've reported on it, but I've never played with it.
There was this many loaded in there. But I thought that I haven't seen you find one yet that's like a freebie one that anybody can
use. I don't think they have the freebie ones. I thought that we had weekly tiers that were using them this past week or something, though. Maybe because they had Genie Plus and they were in the park. Yeah, but I don't say I'm tapping through everything and everything requires Genie Plus. But anyway,
there's all sorts.
It's cute. And it gives you a little example at the top, and that's neat. Are you going to, if we ever get Genie Plus, are you going to play with any of these?
To be honest, probably not, because I probably won't remember them. Like that, to me, that's something that is fun to do probably outside of the parks.
Sure.
So when I'm in the parks, I'm distracted by, well, let's be honest, everything. So I'm not gonna be needing to be playing around in my phone to entertain myself, because I could There's be entertained enough. For hours just sitting in silence and looking around at the parks, because that's just me. But I could see how this would be something fun, something cool to like do with kids while you're waiting in a line, or you know, something like that, something to keep.
That's a great idea. Like when you're in line, mm-hmm. I just remember there was a Mac app called Photo Booth that used to do all these like weird things with your face, and I remember my old roommate would sit there and laugh at that for hours. So I feel like it's very similar to that. Well, a new attraction is joining the Haunted Mansion, Jungle Cruise, and others in the board game universe. Space Mountain is a new game from Ravensburger that is now available for purchase. The game includes pieces from all 5 Space Mountains around the world. Players will race to see who could complete their missions and visit all 5 spaceports first, while avoiding cosmic events, and keep an eye on their fuel levels. The game is made for 2 to 4 players, ages 8 and up, and game time between 20 and 40 minutes.
This looks so fun. Okay, first of all, the game looks beautiful. Like, the artwork for the box, the artwork for the board and pieces itself, very fun. And I like that it's not just themed to look like just one Space Mountain, and that they've kind of brought every version of Space Mountain in on it. I think that's really cool. But this looks so, I don't know. I'm sold. I don't even really understand what, like, how to play the game or anything like that. It just looks really cool and really fun. I want it.
I want it too. It looks really cool. I like the idea. I like that these games are coming out and they've got really interesting, like, play styles. Mm-hmm. And they end up being fun games. We've liked the Jungle Cruise game. We've liked the Haunted Mansion game. Both totally different from each other.
Yeah.
There's a Big Thunder game, which I think would be fun to have, but I haven't bought or played that one yet.
There's a Big Thunder game. It's a Small World game, too.
Mm. Yeah. Do you have to play It's a Small World, like, while you play it? Like, It's a Small World.
I mean, I guess you could. Maybe get bonus points
if
you
play it. We should play it with Vern, and that would distract him, and then he would not do well or something. If we were playing, like, competitively.
There you go.
I'm excited, though. I like these games. I'm glad that they keep being successful, so they keep making more. I wonder what they would make next. I feel like they've hit all the big attractions.
Matterhorn.
Oh, that would be cool. Huh. Okay. I have, like, I'm like
Matterhorn, thinking, Pirates of the Caribbean.
Has it not been a Pirates game?
Based on the attraction?
No, maybe not.
I don't know. Hmm. Yeah. Hmm. All sorts of, the possibilities are, there's lots. Well, some favorite souvenirs from around the parks are going up in price. For the first time since 2018, prices have gone up for the open edition pins. Previously, the silver colored pins were $9.99, which has now increased to $11.99. The yellow pins have increased to $14.99 from $12, and the pink pricing has remained at $14.99. The blue tier has been removed altogether. Something else that went up in price too, another favorite, especially for me, are mini ears, but they have gone up from the base price of $29.99, and they are now $34.99.
Didn't the ears used to be like $24.99?
They were, and prior to that, they were back in my day. No, so the first
for once
time,
it's not me. Yes,
yeah. So the first time I haven't been buying ears that long. It took me a long time, which is wild to think of now with how many I have. It took me a long time to kind of get my to dip my toes in the world of ears, because I just knew it was going to be a problem. And my other problem was I couldn't decide which pair to be needed to be my first pair of ears. So the first set of ears that I purchased was in 2018 at Pixar Fest.
You started that late?
I started that late. My first set of, when we first started this podcast, I did not own a single pair of
Well, see,
ears.
I would have thought that that is crazy. I would have thought that the first choice would have been obvious of like classic mini
ears.
But
there's different versions of the classic. Anyways, this is a whole different can of worms. But it was $19.99 when I bought those ears.
So they've almost doubled in price since you got your first pair. Mm-hmm. Wow.
They have been rising exponentially. Now, that is crazy. I will say there are more options now. They are more elaborate.
Sure.
Because it used to just be like ears.
Sure.
And a different color, different whatever. But now we've got all sorts of themes. They're kind of like made out of, some of them are made of like that like leathery kind of stuff. Yeah. There's little extra embellishments on the bows.
Well, so this is.
It is a little bit more. But still, I just.
This is hitting both of our favorite
both of our homes. Like,
because I like pins and you like the ears.
And pins, I feel like the
$11.99
for the lowest priced open edition pin. So the open edition pins, for those of you that don't know, we're talking about in the different colors that we're talking about. These are the pins that when you pick them up off the board, they don't actually have a price on the back. It's just it's color coordinated. And so they say, oh, if it's yellow, a yellow pin is this, and you know, that sort of a thing. There are other pins, and open edition means they're just they're available and they'll
they're
just
not
keep
limited
making them,
to a certain amount.
Whereas limited edition, yes, they only made a certain amount, and once they're gone, kind of thing. So this makes me sad because pins, especially, used to be a great souvenir. It was inexpensive,
small,
and you know, easily collectible. But when they start, and same thing with ears, not small, but to me, $20 for the pairs of ears, I thought that was a great price point. Yeah. $25 was like, okay, yeah, I get it. Now, $30 to $35, it's like, yeesh, it's getting expensive.
Yeah,
and they keep coming out with more. So, yeah, it's going to be really hard.
Because weren't they, not even that long ago, the base price was like $27, and then they went to $29, and now they've gone to
The prices have been hiking up fast.
At what price will you have to stop buying ears?
Well, I've already started slowing down. I used to buy a pair a trip, and I don't do that every trip. It's got to be a pretty dang special set of ears for me to purchase them now, because especially now at starting at $35, that's really
really
pricey.
It's the same price as a Magic Band thing now. You can start your Magic Band collection.
Nope. We're not collect one and done on the Magic Bands. I can't.
Let's mark this moment in time. The Teresa will only have one magic band.
If I could, I would use my magic band that is sitting downstairs that I got at Disney World for free with our hotel stay.
Yeah, I just...
That's not something that I want...
I'm calling
it
now.
You're
gonna have,
want to invest money
You're
going to
have more than one. Even if it's just two, you're going to have more than one. Because you're going to see another design and you're going to be like...
I don't know. If I was
There's
local
gonna be like a
and
nice
used,
Haunted Mansion
I don't know.
One or something.
If I was local and using them more frequently, maybe, but I don't think I will.
I'm worried that this is going to be my new thing, that like every trip I'm going to buy a new magic band.
It's going to be, yes, I think magic bands are going to be a problem for you. I don't think
I love the magic bands.
I
love the magic bands.
But yeah, I just.
See, you got to be like Shannon. You got to have different ones for different holidays. She's saying one for Christmas and a normal one. Kate is saying Halloween and a Christmas one.
Yeah, no, I'm gonna go with a color and stick with it. I'm gonna get one of the plain color ones, I think, or I'll get like a generic, like one of the Disneyland themed ones, or maybe that magic key one if I can somehow get a magic key one, and solely get the magic key one just because I get the $10 discount on it, because everything's getting more and more expensive as we're talking about right now.
Okay, so, well, if you want to talk about more expenses,
I'm
Disney's
very sad about this
photo
too.
Pass capture your moment private photo shoots have also increased in price. The 20-minute session with up to 8 guests was priced at $79, which, if we remember correctly, I thought was outrageous at the time.
You did.
It's now $99 for that 20 minutes. As a reminder, photos are not included and must be purchased separately or linked to a photo pass account.
To me, this is now getting too high. I could see more people taking advantage and utilizing the service at the $79 price point. And I don't know, $99 for 20 minutes. I think we're stepping into the not as many people are going to be able to do this range. $79, you could do. I know this is going to sound crazy. It's only $20 between the two prices, but it's just.
Well, you're adding an extra dollar per minute.
Well, that's true. The thing that's crazy to me about this, though, is I would like to know why, because we just came out with the service. I mean, this year for sure. It's only been a couple of months. We could go back and look at when this is, when they first came out with this, but it hasn't been around that long. So it's surprising to me that they're already increasing the price on it, unless this is something that they're trying to do because the demand's been too high. So they're trying to get the demand a little bit lower, but I can't imagine that. So this also makes me sad. I'm sad. I get that things need to, yes, Disney is a business and all that, but I just feel like I'm not understanding these price increases here.
Yeah, it's outrageous. I know that there's some concerns with inflation and all these things, but it's just like the last couple weeks, all we've talked about is like prices going up. I mean, in this episode alone, we had three stories, didn't we? Wasn't it two or three stories of pricing increasing? So
yeah,
it's tough.
Last week we talked about ticket increase.
Yep. And Genie Plus and parking and all that stuff. Yeah. So, well, maybe next week, maybe it'll be like, prices have gone down, but I doubt it.
I somehow doubt that too.
DO Weekly announces the boarding of the Trivia Express, nonstop star speeder service to the moon of Endor. All passengers, please prepare for immediate boarding.
Welcome to Trivia Land. How are we feeling tonight? You excited? You got some good trivia thinking caps on? You ready for this?
We'll find out.
No, I'm a little nervous about this because we were chatting before the recording and there were other trivia questions that were planned to be asked tonight. Vern was looking through them and got not confused, but was like, I don't know much about that. So looked it up and now we have all brand new trivia questions. So I'm a little nervous that tonight's trivia stemmed from Vern not knowing something.
Because I fell down a rabbit hole.
I don't feel like this is a good way to start.
Your rabbit hole is rubbing off on Vern. That's what's happening.
It was a very interesting rabbit hole. It was an attraction I'd never heard of before. And I...
What do you suppose this is?
I don't know. Maybe that's the first question. What attraction do you think it is?
You're going to find out in the first sentence of the first question.
Okay.
So are you ready to fall down my rabbit hole with me?
Yes.
Let's go.
Excellent. Let's do it. Do you remember Superstar Limo?
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, I know a little bit about this.
I never went on it, but yes, I've heard of it.
I never went on it.
Was that our first question? Did we get it right?
No.
You've never heard of Superstar Limo, Vern?
I had never heard of it before.
It was short-lived, and he didn't visit the park while
I was
there.
That's true. Yep. It's infamous.
Superstar Limo was the first dark ride in Disney California Adventure, and after receiving terrible reviews, it was the first ride in DCA to permanently close. What dates, month/year, was this attraction open?
February 2001 is when it opened with the park.
For sure 2001.
And I'm guessing, he wants month and year. And I'm going to say it closed in, it wasn't very long, 2002, I'll say March of 2002.
Now, here's my question. Did it sit empty for quite a while, or did they reskin it to Monsters, Inc. fairly quick? Because when
I don't think it was too long. Yeah. I don't think that it was done when the movie, I don't think it was a direct, the movie came out. I just think they rethemed it to that later.
Oh, so it sat for a little bit, not for
a terribly long time, I would guess. But I'm looking at your Disneyland encyclopedia that probably would tell us.
That is very true. I'm sorry. You said March of 02?
March of 02 is when it closed. And I would say,
I think it was open longer than that. I think
that's over a year. February 2001 to March of 02?
Just barely over a year. I think it was a little bit longer than that.
Okay.
But I don't know if it was later in 02 or if it was 03. I'm going to say 2000. I'll do February of 03.
Oh, so 2 years. Okay.
All right. So you both agree that it opened in February of 01 and Tag says it closed in March of 02 and Teresa says it closed in February of 03.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Final answers.
Yeah.
Final.
Excellent. The original concept for Superstar Limo was that riders were celebrities being chauffeured around and being chased by paparazzi. Mm-hmm. At the beginning and end of the ride, a video starring then CEO Blank welcomed the riders to the attraction and then bid them farewell.
Mike Eisner.
Oh, yeah.
Is that your final answer?
Bob Iger.
Yes, Michael Eisner. That was awful.
I was like, Teresa? Yeah, because Michael Eisner was CEO till 2005 when Bob Iger took over.
Do you know what was worse is I saw Michael Eisner's face in my head
as
I
said Bob Iger.
Bob, and I was like, nope. No, no, no.
All right. Your third regular round question. Still in my weird rabbit hole with me.
I mean, I now understand why you were confused by Superstar Limo. Yeah. Because it was, from what I've heard.
Yeah, it's a very unique attraction.
A confusing and unique thing. And if you didn't know it existed, it's a very not
very kind
typical
of un-Disney.
Disney thing.
Yeah.
So your third question. After the death of Princess Diana while being chased by paparazzi, it was deemed poor taste to have an attraction based on being chased by paparazzi. The ride was changed to feature celebrities in a ride through Hollywood. Can you name the featured celebrities?
I know Drew Carey was in there.
I think I feel like Whoopi Goldberg was in there because she was in the other part. How many were there, Vern?
Ten.
My gosh.
We got Drew Carey and Whoopi Goldberg. So that's two. I don't know if I could tell you anymore. Who were famous people back in 2001?
I genuinely only know. Is it like, but it'd be people you'd see in California. So like Dolly Parton probably would not be on that list.
Well, do you think when they rejiggered it, did they... Oh, I guess Princess Diana wasn't in it.
No, she wasn't in it.
I don't remember who all the famous people were back then.
I didn't ever experience this. I have just seen, I've seen photos of it.
Drew Carey is the one that I always see photos of. I do want to say that voice of DL Weekly, Andy Mack, also a previous guest, is in our chat that we're streaming into. And he said he knows a bunch of these. But why? Why do I know this information? I mean, for a trivia like today.
For this exact moment, Andy, that's why.
But I'm going to click off because I don't want him to say anything in there and then we end up
You don't want to. You don't want to phone a friend? Phone our friend Andy Mack?
No. No, no, no.
Well, I'm giving up because those are the only ones.
I give up too. So Drew Carey, Whoopi Goldberg, and I don't know of anybody else.
Okay.
Jennifer Aniston?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
All right. So Drew Carey, Whoopi Goldberg, and Jennifer Aniston. Is that your final answers?
Yeah.
All right.
And let's add a line for Andy.
And then Andy's saying Jackie Chan,
Cindy Crawford, and Tim Allen.
Oh, Tim Allen, huh?
Yeah. We got some more typing. So hold on. We might have some more here.
If Andy knows all 10, I'm going to fall over.
No, he just said it was the worst ride in the history of the company. All right. That's good.
All right. And your fourth and final regular round question. After closing the attraction, a few rethemed ideas were tossed around, trying to keep close to the original idea. Do you know the top two contenders?
No.
No. No, I do not.
No.
No?
Wow. I'm curious about that.
Yeah, me too.
Is that your final answer?
Yes.
Yep.
Okay.
So apparently we're not feeling very good about this tonight.
All right. And your bonus question tonight. Which ride replaced Superstar Limo and still functions in that space to this day?
Monsters, Inc. Mike and Sully to the rescue.
I was going
to
say, do you know the little tagline for it?
Mm-hmm.
You do.
It's so cute.
Now I'm curious.
Monsters, Inc. Mike and Sully to the rescue. Is that your final answer?
Yes.
Yes.
All right. Well, listeners, how much do you know about Superstar Limo? How do you feel about what Tag and Teresa know about Superstar Limo? Stick around and we can all find out together.
Well, this week for our discussion topic, we are speaking with founder, CEO of Storyland Studios and a Disney alumnus. We were trying to figure that out beforehand. But let's welcome Mel McGowan to the show. Hi, Mel.
Hey, good to be with you guys. Thanks for the invite.
Well, we are so excited to kind of dive into your Disney history and just talk all things Disney with you. But first, we'd like to get to know you a little better. Can you please tell us your Disney story?
Ooh. Well, it's probably pretty early in the DNA. My two earliest memories growing up, I've probably told the story too many times, but earliest memory, I was born in Vietnam, outside of Saigon. So I remember bombs going off and got out right before the fall of Saigon.
Wow.
And then the second earliest memory, kind of slightly contrasted with that, was looking down Main Street USA at night and seeing the pin lights outlining the building. So there was kind of a, you know, two contrasting visions and memories of the world, probably the world as it was versus the world that could and should be. And I think those two memories kind of collided and burned itself into my brain, because even though I didn't really grow up in Southern California, I grew up in Germany, kind of a military brat. You know, I still, you know, have this weird memory slash image of what really, not just Disney, but to me, that was what America was, as opposed to, the environment that I grew up in. And so just that kind of, you know, created an early spark of inspiration where I started drawing theme parks and future cities and stuff when I was, probably 10, 11, 12 years old. So that was probably the start of the story. But my dad actually did work at Disney. So that was one of the reasons we got to see those lights down Main Street. I wrote my first letter to, what was then called WED Enterprises. Now it's Walt Disney Imagineering. I think when I was probably 12, to get my first rejection letter, stay in school, kid. And then the first time I got to go to Disneyland, I actually sent him another letter, offering all this great free creative consulting and all the ideas that they needed to, actually it was more things they needed to fix, as well as some blue sky ideas, and got my second cease and desist letter at that point. So that was
kid, move on.
Set those sites pretty early on, and then got to go work there when I was still finishing up my film degree. So
That's incredible.
What did your dad do?
He was just moonlighting. He was in the military, so he was moonlighting, worked for Ron Dominguez, Dick Nunes, some of those old operator guys in security and theme park operations. So his real claim to fame was he played stand-up bass, and so he got to jam with the Royal Street Bachelors every once in a while. And so that was kind of a big deal. So every time I don't know if you've been to the Club 33, but there's a kind of a side lounge, jazz lounge, and they've got a painting of the bachelors, and the gimmick of the room is that each of the bachelors slowly disappear, and then you see their ghost playing the instrument. And so I always kind of think of my dad getting to jam with these.
Oh, that's so cool.
Musicians when I see him. So.
Wow, it's on our bucket list to try to get into Club 33. I know we actually have a listener who is trying to, he's on the wait list, and he's trying to get in. He actually has a friend that is a member, and so he's trying to work some magic for us to try to get us in there, but we have not been lucky enough to do that yet, but we are very excited to. And there was another listener too who had invited us, but scheduling has just never worked out for it. So one of these days, I heard it's totally
whenever
awesome
you can
and magical.
Fit it into your schedule, I highly recommend it.
Well, if we lived out there, we would make it happen, but because we have to fly out there and do all that stuff, it becomes a little challenging, unfortunately.
I hear you.
All right. Well, let's see how you do on this one. So when you go to Disneyland on the first day of one of your, of a visit, which way do you go? Do you go left towards Adventureland? Do you go through the Castle to Fantasyland? Do you go right towards Tomorrowland? How do you kind of attack it first day of the park?
Okay. That's an easy question. The harder question would have been, the right tunnel or the left tunnel. But the easy question is clockwise, got to go through Adventureland, mostly because that was the way that my dad, who gave me one of the best guided tours on the first trip that I was old enough to remember, took me through. And back then, again, before the pay one price, you really did one land at a time, and you did the A, B, C, D, E attractions, and it was land by land and one cohesive loop, and there was none of the zigzagging e-ticket marathon kind of stuff trying to get you fast passes or whatever. So it was like, to me, that's the proper way to go, because and second to that, Tomorrowland just looks way better at night, kind of like Vegas. It looks way better at night than it does in the daytime, and there's a little bit of energy there, but that's kind of like tradition for me. But like I said, I think the trickier question is tunnel right, tunnel left. I'd love to hear
now,
your answer.
Now I need to know tunnel right or tunnel left for you. We always tend to go right. I have no idea why.
Okay. Well, that's the right way to go.
Okay.
And, I say that for two reasons. It's a lot easier, especially first-time guests, to not get the visual intrusions of the old admin building, the Matterhorn, Space Mountain, but the second reason for me, I love taking guests through and showing them Tony Baxter's 1955 opening day recreation model in the Lincoln lobby there. So that's pretty awesome as orientation piece to the park. So
that's really interesting.
You got to show them Walt's apartment, of course, on the way out.
It's really interesting because I want to say the not consecutive, but in the last 8 months we've had three, I think, guests when we've asked this question, ask about the tunnels or mention the tunnels. Mm-hmm. And before that, like, nobody had mentioned the tunnels to us. And so the last couple times we went, Teresa and I paid attention to that because for whatever reason, that's the way. Yeah. I will say,
it's your establishing shot. It's the opening, you know.
Yeah.
And it's a big deal. You
know? But your rationale behind it's really good that you're not getting all the visual intrusions. Now, the other thing, too, is for some reason, I feel like other trips, not this last one, but generally, I feel like when I exit on the right-hand side because I always do this thing on the last night of a trip. I stop right before the exit, before the tunnel, and mm-hmm. I turn around. I get one last look of Main Street. Usually, it's at night. This trip, we happen to leave in the middle of the day, but usually, it's at night, so it's really pretty. I take it all in, and I do a till next time, and I turn around, and I don't look back. You know, I turn around, and I walk out. Yep. And usually, it's that tunnel, but for some reason, this last time, we went out the other tunnel, but it was also middle of the day, so who knows? But
I'm with you. Exit on the right.
Yeah.
So, speaking of favorite things at the park, what is your favorite attraction? And even though this is a Disneyland podcast, we do allow you to choose any attraction from any of the Disney parks.
Oh, okay. Well, that's actually an easy one either way. You know, again, along with those two early memories I shared with you, one of those other from that same trip looking down the lights I had forgotten was flying out the Darling window.
Yep.
And Peter Pan's flight. And again, I probably was maybe four. It was around the fall of Saigon. So I was 1974. When I came back and I was old enough to kind of have some sense of what was going on, that was the one thing. And my dad wouldn't let me. We were going around clockwise, but I was dying to figure out how they pulled that off. How did I get thrown out the window and I didn't die? And well, anyways, it's fun though, because we got to work on the e-ticket version of Peter Pan. I've actually gotten to work on a few Peter Pan attractions over the years, but that's a special one for me. And it's finally getting a much deserved e-ticket in Tokyo. Mm-hmm. And if you haven't heard about, you know, Fantasy Springs and
it's so incredible. Cool. Like, I wanted to go to Tokyo anyways. We haven't been, but now seeing what they're doing there, I'm just like, yeah. Man.
Well, now you got to wait.
Now I have to wait. I'm like, I can't go now. Yeah. I got to wait. Yeah. But it looks so cool.
I always say, you know, for anybody who's been listening to the podcast for a while, this is just repeating the same thing. But Oriental Land Company, man, I love them because it's just like, here's a check, whatever you need, make it happen. And like, you know, design whatever, over design whatever. We don't care. Unlike the U.S. parks where it seems like, where can we kind of keep this as lowest budget possible.
There's pros and cons. I'll tell you, it's not quite that easy, but you know, it comes with its own challenges. But I will tell you that there is a consistency there for sure. Mm-hmm. You don't have these big pendulum swings with different leader personalities and, you know, we're going to tighten the range. We're going to, you know, go all IP crazy or this or that. They definitely almost have the Bible of Jim Cora, Dick Nunes, you know, the spirit of Walt Disney. They don't mess with those operating principles. And it's definitely a challenge to get stuff approved creatively. But you're right. They definitely understand the ROI of investing in quality, which does really harken back to Walt's approach of, you know, hey, I don't really care so much about the spreadsheet. I want to, you know, I'm going to intuitively know that this is worthy of.
Well, I think what it comes down to is that if you look in history, is the company does best when you have a creative leader and a financial leader together, like working in tandem. So when you had Walt and Roy, things were doing really well. When you had Eisner and Wells, things were working really well. And it's when one of those folks is gone and it becomes too creative or too financial, that's what you end up with. So right now, I think we're too financial because I think Bob Chapek is really focused on money and the bottom line and the shareholders and everything. But, you know, a few years, you know, when Eisner, you know, it was just Eisner and he lost the financial side, it seemed like that caused some problems too. So it's, you know, it's just, it's a hard thing and it's hard. It's rare to have a company that you need two people kind of leading it, but from two kind of different ways. But let's talk about your journey with Disney and what you've done. And of course, I'm sure we'll talk about what you do today too, but how did you get started with Disney? How did that come about working for Disney? And is there anything special that stands out to you that you think is super interesting to talk about?
Well, like I said, I mean, I was probably had my sights set on Disney pretty early on. I was getting ready to graduate, and I was actually interviewing for some international jobs that would have been sexy and cool and fun and, you know, pretty good compensation. And, you know, I had actually one guy offered me a pretty amazing job, but he just said, everything about you, every word you're saying, you're like oozing, you know, this pixie dust aura that screams Disney. That and he's just like, you know, I'll be honest with you, you have this job if you want it. But if I was your dad, if I was, you know, giving you any advice, it just seems like if you got into the right fertile soil, the right kind of ecosystem, and, you know, like Disney, it would be worth just getting in to sweep, you know, just get a job in the broom closet, you know, as a sweeper, whatever, you know, that you'll do well, you know. And I took his advice. And so I was still finishing film school, but I went to work at the Disneyland Hotel for $7 an hour, getting yelled at by angry guests because Disney had just bought the hotel. They hadn't renovated it. They hadn't designed it or built it. We had, ratted carpets, cockroaches. It was kind of a, you know, it's a long story, but basically to be able to get over there and start, going through their leadership development and training stuff, get a little bit of operation stuff, and to be able to finish my grad degree at Cal Poly, same school that Barbara Boozman and Bob Weiss went to a little bit before me, but to get the master's degree focused on master planning, design, architecture, all that good stuff, all those design disciplines, and then for actually Disney to pay for that while I was working on the project. And, you know, I don't know how far back your history goes with Disney, but when I started there in 1990, you know, Disneyland was always great, of course, but the city around it was kind of sort of going to hell in a handbasket, and you had hookers walking the streets, and you could rent rooms by the hour for use with those, you know, nice ladies, and you could rent the rooms for the month, you know, if you're homeless getting ready to, you know, lose your apartment and you needed a kitchenette unit. And you know, we had stray bullets going right through the glass of the Disneyland Hotel. Welcome to the happiest place on earth, you know, right around where they're building the new DVC tower right now that used to overlook a pretty rough neighborhood called the Jeffrey Lynn neighborhood. So, you know, the task of not just coming up with a new ride, you know, because Disney had, you know, done that while I was there, you know, Indiana Jones, you know, the whatever anniversary that was a kind of a big deal in 1995. But they got to the point where we couldn't just keep reinvesting, you know, $100 million attractions with the area around it kind of decaying. And, you know, and they had recognized, of course, the resort, you know, length of stay model that Disney World and all the other Disney parks around that, you know, what happens when you have a second gate, when you have a longer length of stay, you know, higher per capita spend. And so, you know, the opportunity to work with Disney, the city, figuring out how to work the strategery, left brain, right brain finances to, again, not just do a second park, but really to, again, to clean up what eventually became, I think, 1,100 acres that Disney ended up acquiring, expanding from that original 160 acres of orange groves. So, you know, not quite, but almost 2 square miles, you know, that surrounded the, not only the Disney property, but the former Anaheim commercial recreation zone. So long story, but, you know, you don't often get to tear up a 100-acre black asphalt parking lot and put up a paradise and put up a national park. And that was kind of a challenge, you know, like, you know, my wife loves the Wilderness Lodge, and I always feel like, wow, the Grand California was kind of, you know, a harder design challenge because we didn't have this pristine natural 400-acre lake and cypress forest. And, you know, we actually had to create the view, you know, the Grizzly Peak. And so, yeah, it's kind of fun to let people, you know, actually spend the night in a Disney park. Cause that was one of the stories I remember my dad would tell me. He'd try to sweep the park, you know, at night in security, and they'd try to, you know, walk through, make sure everybody's out. And every once in a while they'd have kids like kind of sneak onto the parts of the Caribbean, jump over the boat, try to hide out in the little Caribbean village. And I remember thinking, you should not have told me that. That is an awesome, awesome idea.
You're like, wait, can't wait to try it.
So from the second I got in the door, I was fixated on, you know, going beyond just 8 to 12 hour guest experience, but what would it look like to let people fall asleep, wake up, you know, in the magic. And, you know, eventually that, you know, we tried some different locations between Main Street, Tomorrowland, on the Rivers of America, where Star Wars Galaxy's Edge is now. We had looked at doing a Wilderness Lodge type concept, but, you know, finally getting to do the Grand Californian in the Golden State Grizzly Peak area was kind of a dream. Of course, the next level of evolution of that is Galaxy's Edge and the Star Cruiser. But now we're getting to do projects, you know, beyond Disney that expand that to a whole nother level and a different scale. So that's kind of fun. Some of the international work we're getting to do these days of kind of blurring the line between, you know, attractions and live entertainment and kind of theater and hospitality. And yeah, it's kind of fun kind of breaking those paradigms a little bit.
Wow.
It's, you know, so the first time I visited Downtown Disney, you know, that was all like that was in development. And I remember my first visit, it was like walls and like DCA's coming kind of thing. So I never got to visit the parks when it was kind of the parks here and the Disneyland hotels way over there. And that's that.
And the parking lot.
Oh, yeah, there's a parking lot. So it's really interesting for me to hear about the time when all of, you know, when Downtown Disney and Grand Californian and even the Disneyland Hotel in its current state wasn't a thing. It just goes together so cohesively, and it makes so much sense that it's really hard for me to think that, oh no, this was like, this happened later. So kudos to everyone that you included and everyone that did that, because it's fascinating. So can you kind of talk to us about that process? How do you take that blank page basically of like neighborhoods and stuff and say, oh well, we're just gonna boop, put this here? Because like I said, it just fits so well. It's amazing to me.
Well, I got to give, you know, a lot of credit where it's due. You know, I had some, you know, great mentors and some really truly great kind of visionaries and urban designers that really, you know, guys like Tim Regalen, you know, a lot of names that aren't really known to Disney fandom, you know, these days. Wing Chow is a kind of a Disney legend. A lot of people, yeah, you know Wing, but you know, the designers that were interested beyond the berm, you know, not just trying to do a new, you know, ride, you know, but actually thinking at a bigger urban mixed use kind of scale. And in the case of Disneyland, I mean, because we could talk about projects at any location around the world, but every site has to me, a soil specific story. And, you know, we actually start with the idea of story of, and we actually have a process we go through at Storyland Studios called Story Circles, where we actually try to facilitate lots of conversations around, you know, these three story circles of character, setting, and plot. And, you know, in a lot of ways, I learned that from the process of how we figured out the right story to tell on that black asphalt, you know, former citrus grove in Anaheim of trying to figure out, okay, what's the unique psychographic demographics of the audience that we're trying to, you know, speak to? What's the setting, the soil specific context and setting that, you know, what's a story that could and should only be told on this site right across from Walt's original creation in Disneyland? Because, you know, it's easy to cut and paste concepts from, you know, before I got involved, there was a one that got away project called Westcott, you know, a West Coast version of Epcot. And as cool as that would have been, you know, and, you know, I know Doris Hardoon, you know, Tony Beck, there are some amazing Imagineers that were looking to do something that was far more dense and complex and beautiful and lush than even as much as I love Epcot Center in Florida. It still would have been the West Coast version of Epcot. You know, I mean, it wasn't this fully original kind of thing. And so, again, you know, I just big believer that there's some unique story to tell on it on each site. You know, and then again, the plot, you know, why are we even doing this? And I think at a high level, just touched on some of the whys behind doing something in Anaheim, where we have to protect this investment, you know, or else it's almost better just pull up stake and go to landfill in Long Beach and do Disney Seas, you know, like they were talking about doing. And, you know, ultimately the idea of shoring up that original investment, that original destination of Disneyland, finding the right complement to that, you know, the original strategy was, okay, we don't want to do more of the same. We want to contrast intentionally with that. From a master planning perspective, I can just share with you, one of my things was connecting the dots, you know, connectivity, you know, because the original park was, and I'm going to have to really edit here because I could go on for hours. The original park was, you know, very much done to mid-century utopian modernist planning, you know, based on freeways and cars, right? So you had a freeway off-ramp, you had a gated theme park, and then you had an ocean of parking, and then you had these big arterial streets, you know, that surrounded this, you know, square mile grid. No one would ever think that you might want to go from your motel across Harbor Boulevard and actually get on your feet and walk to the front gate of Disneyland. No one ever thought that you might want to leave your hotel room at the Disneyland Hotel and walk into Disneyland. Why would anyone do that when we've got, you know, buses and cars and trams and whatever? I mean, I remember when the monorail operation was down at Disneyland Hotel, you know, guests would easily wait 45, 50 minutes for the next monorail for a tram. They would never think of crossing that big desert of cars. And so there was a level of just trying to say, hey, how can we connect the dots from, you know, the Disneyland Hotel on one end to the pedestrian spine of retail and the restaurants, Harbor Boulevard, you know, because there's kind of a, there's enough of a, just a public urbane, you know, just trying to be nice to the family that can't afford to be at the Grand California, and like, they should be able to, you know, walk to the park too. And so we had almost a three quarters of a mile of stuff to connect. Wow. And so trying to figure out how we can make that pedestrian connection happen. And by the way, that's a long walk. I mean, most malls, when you do retail planning, that's like a quarter mile, 5 minute walk from one end of the anchor store to the other anchor. Most people, if they saw how long it was, they would do exactly what those guests did, you know, at the Disneyland Hotel. They wouldn't even think of walking it. They would say, yeah, forget that, I'll wait. And this is before Uber, before whatever, but they'll wait for a tram or whatever. And so we designed this kind of curvilinear meandering pedestrian spine that, you know, you never quite see how long it is. There's a fountain or there's a tower or there's something to kind of, you know, breadcrumbs to kind of keep you walking before you realize, hey, I just happen to be in the middle of these two great theme parks. And then, you know, separate from that, whenever you have things like surface parking and you're in more of an urban context, like Disneyland became in the 90s, land isn't as cheap as it was when it was Orange Groves, right? If you're in Manhattan or downtown LA and now Orange County, when land costs over $1 million an acre, you're not thinking surface parking anymore. And so that idea of, you know, needing to go up, doing the world's largest parking garage, keeping cars off surface streets, doing direct freeway on ramps, off ramps from the HOV lanes. I mean, a lot of this stuff was utopian Buck Rogers kind of futuristic master planning that, you know, was kind of, we felt in the spirit of what Walt Disney was trying to do. Actually, one of his biggest urban planning influences was a guy named Victor Gruen, an Austrian architect that designed the shopping mall. But Victor Gruen became ashamed of the shopping mall. He called his bastard children. But he was really into future, you know, planned communities. So his firm actually designed some of the master plan communities in Orange County. But Walt Disney was really enamored with some of his thinking and work and a lot of his approach of having cars kind of, you know, parked around the perimeter and parking garage and really keeping the core as a pedestrian spine was really kind of came from his work. And we actually were able to execute and implement that. So in some ways, we feel like what we did at Disneyland Resort was actually truer in spirit to some of the thinking around what Epcot, the city was going to be so than a permanent World's Fair or a crazy sprawling 45 square mile, very beautiful, very magical suburban sprawl where you have to take buses and boats and cable cars from one park to another when, you know, you could just do it, you know, because I love the fact that you could just park a car and not think about it for a couple of days and, you know, walk at the scale of little kids' feet and get around. Because you know, it really harkens back to my childhood in Europe where you could actually walk for miles and just have a wonderful time and have a full life, you know, at the scale of a human being and feet rather than freeways.
It's interesting that you mentioned with Downtown Disney that it's purposely set up to kind of make it so you can't see from, you know, one end to the other so that you don't have that daunting, oh my gosh. I'm going to admit I was today years old when I realized, oh yeah, that is a way longer walk because I have been following those breadcrumbs happily for years now. And I know in my brain it's long because it takes a while, but it never, like you just said, it doesn't, because of how it's set up visually, it doesn't ever feel like it's,
you know what it felt like that. So when we were there for your wedding and I had to go back to the hotel that was off a harbor, but her wedding was happening at the Disneyland Hotel. When you're trying to just get somewhere and you're navigating through people and you're not paying attention to those breadcrumbs or the curves and you're just paying attention, like I'm trying to get somewhere, I've got a mission. That's how you can tell when you know it's a long way, because I remember walking through going, I feel like this is never going to end. And then you get through, then the Esplanade even is really wide because usually that's where you're stopping. Mm-hmm. Right. So you cut the Esplanade in half usually. But I was walking through the Esplanade. That was big too. A couple things I want to say about that design. One of the most impressive things to me about the Downtown Disney section is that area between Tortilla Joe's and the Disney and ESPN Zone or whatever it is now. That is a bridge that goes over a road, but you would never, if you didn't know that or pay attention to that, you would never know that that's what was happening. And that is amazing to me because you can't even hear traffic.
No.
And it's right there.
Well, you know, that was definitely one of the consternation points, you know, because there were different designs to go more north-south, you know, from the Disney Hotel to the Future Garage. I thought it was really important to be able to walk to the parks and have more of that east-west spine. And that road used to be called West Street. That was the western boundary of the city of Anaheim, now named Disneyland Drive. Mm-hmm. That was kind of a big deal, right? And so that original, a lot of the original master plan we did for the Disneyland Hotel, we called it West of West. Wow. That was the resort area around the Paradise Pier, what's now going to be the Pixar Place Hotel, mm-hmm. the Disneyland Hotel, and the campground, the parking areas. But I was really concerned because I thought people aren't going to want to cross that right. moat, right, of the parking, because it's a pretty fast moving wide arterial mm-hmm. street. And so working with the city, you know, to go ahead and dip that road down. But it's one thing to do a pedestrian bridge, which is already expensive, but to drop the road beneath it, it's not as insane as some of the water bridges they have in Florida, where you got, you know, steamships crossing right over,
right.
you know, the roadway, but still is pretty aggressive because that's a public right of way street. And that's the bigger half is we really had to partner with the city and yeah. there was a whole public private partnership there, helping them figure out how much money they could spend and without taking a dime out of the resident taxes, mm-hmm. You know, and really being paid for out of the hotel bed tax. But, you know, from a design perspective, one of the things I'll say about that is I lost the battle because I thought that we needed buildings on that. We needed a Ponte Vecchio. We needed to totally hide the street and the palm trees. And the reality is, you know, just putting the little carts and the tables and umbrella and, you know, a layer of planting, it was okay that you still saw those, you know, Beverly Hills style, you know, Sunset Boulevard palm trees. People don't even notice. It just feels mm-hmm. like California. Mm-hmm. And so I was arguing for probably what would have been a little bit even more of an expensive, elaborate solution, but I'm glad it worked out. So,
yeah, that's just amazing. The other aspect that's in that same kind of vicinity that I personally, I love it. Teresa doesn't get she doesn't have the attachment to it with the nostalgia like I do, I guess.
Oh, yeah.
But the tram route from the parking garage to Disneyland is also just like masterfully done, because you don't really pay attention that you went under the road, you know, that's bringing cars in. You don't pay attention that you're going along a road. Like, there's enough distraction there and trees and everything that it's, you don't even realize that you're right there doing this. And it's such a, it's, you know, in Florida, everybody talks about the Disney bubble. And I feel like when you get into the parking structure, whether it's the Pixar Pals parking structure or Mickey and Friends Now, as soon as you get on that tram, you've kind of entered the bubble for the day. And so you are going through, there's a lot of greenery, there's some decorations, there's music playing. It's just amazing. And it's something that I don't like, you know, people think of all the stuff, like you're saying, like the park stuff, right? Like attractions and lands. But really, all these external things are super important too. Like, how are you going to get people from the garage to there? You want to put the garage on the outskirts, like you were saying, but you don't want to just put it right there. You want to put it like far north and to the side. Like, you don't want it to be anywhere near the entrance. I don't know. It's just, I love it. I just want to say, I think it's done great.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I mean, I'm glad you recognize there's some good modernist, clean architectural design in the garage. And, you know, as far as flow, there's some beautiful landscape architecture that, you know, SWA from Laguna Beach did, the layers. I mean, because you're tramming past a lot of mm-hmm. back of house areas, and to screen that, and, you know, to the point where a lot of people were just choosing to walk, you know, rather than wait for the next tram, or, you know, I mean, obviously during COVID when they weren't running trams,
right.
You know, it's actually not that bad of a walk. So pretty big deal. I can't believe, I'm so bummed that the garage on the eastern side is still not done, because our whole original master plan flow was that, you know, southbound you'd access those western lots and Mickey and Friends, mm-hmm. but, you know, from the northbound I-5 You know, still waiting patiently to be able to, you know, not have to traverse the resort, but to be able to deck right into a garage and then right. have the trams meet in the middle. That really would help the overall flow. But yeah, it's great that they finally built those pedestrian bridges to downtown mm-hmm. Disney. It kind of makes it really cool.
And I really hope that in the future that they're able to finish the what was called the Eastern Gateway yeah. project, because
exactly, yeah. mm-hmm.
that yeah that
the
would
land
be
is
amazing.
There. The plan's there. The land is there. It's just waiting to happen. I'm just like, I can't believe it. However many years later, quarter right. century, it's still not done. You know,
that but, I feel like that was one of the first things that we like talked about when we started the podcast.
It feels
so
that way.
It's been at least 5 years, I think, but it's yeah.
Yeah, there's some politicking going on there.
Oh, yes.
I'll tell you, sure. though, just I'm curious what your thoughts are. So they have this Disneyland Forward project, mm-hmm. Which I think is good because there's a lot of parking space over there. I mean, if you're going to expand anything, there's not really any room where the old parking area was because right. it's DCA and you've got your shopping and you've got Disneyland. So the only place to expand directly, there's tons of surface lot. Mm-hmm. What do you think about the kind of ideas? I mean, right now it's all blue sky and we haven't really heard much of it since they initially announced it.
Yeah, I mean, generally speaking, I mean, even 20 years plus ago when we were doing the master plan, we recognized that the surface black asphalt parking lots of today or of back then are the fertile fields of imagination for tomorrow, yeah. right? And so the idea that, look, long-term stewardship, you know, it is never going to make sense for this to always be a surface parking lot, right? I think back in the day, we thought we were being pretty radical, innovative in terms of the Disneyland Resort specific plan to cast this vision of an Anaheim Resort Garden District and to have these, you know, rather than the traditional land use zones, residential, retail, commercial, office. You know, we actually said, hey, we'll have some flexibility. We'll create a theme park district. We'll create a parking district, you know, kind of a retail dining entertainment district, a hotel district. And I think, you know, the big news on Disneyland Forward is simply, hey, wouldn't it be great to have something closer to what Disney enjoys in Florida with the Reedy Creek Improvement District? Like, hey, let's just have a Disney district. Because bottom line today, you know, take something like a Galactic Star Cruiser. Is that an attraction? Is it a restaurant?
Yeah.
Is it a, you know, hospitality? Yes. It's all that, you know, so, you know, that idea of if you're doing Westworld, you know, you're blurring the lines. You really want to not have such a distinction between the old fashioned land use thing. So giving Disney the flexibility to basically say, hey, look, we can figure out parking. We'll make it. We could vertically stack parking, but the old suburban horizontal land use separation of, you know, I think of that whole model as I use the analogy of if you've ever had a Chicago deep dish pizza, you know, you enjoy that vertical, you know, stacking of all those ingredients, right? What modern suburban urban planning was we're going to blow up the pizza and we're going to stack the pepperoni in the pepperoni zone, the cheese in the cheese zone,
oh.
crust in the crust zone. We're never going to let you taste a great deep dish pizza again. And that's kind of how old school urbanity worked, you know, from ancient times, that you had people living above their shops and you had people, mm-hmm. you know, doing different things in the spaces between buildings. And that's a little bit of what we tried to do. You know, even like the Grand California and Downtown Disney is a great example. I mean, you're walking above a podium, a parking garage. You're walking on top of the valet garage for the Grand California and ground level retail, you know, like a European inspired piazza inspired by Las Ramblas and then hotel rooms up above. That's actually vertical mixed use. Even though the theme of the hotel is a National Park Lodge, it's probably the most urban mixed use building Disney had ever done. To that point. And again, I think as we look at the future, you know, rather than these horizontal segregated use zones, that's kind of what a lot of Disneyland Forward is about, is just giving Disney the flexibility. So it's, you know, whatever they saw in the press release, a lot of that's probably eyewash, you know, but, you know, I think the key is that, you know, you want to maximize the ability to stack uses and to, you know, maximize experiences wherever that can happen. And again, I think the more magical it's going to be is the more immersive you get to, mm-hmm. you know, just live that experience and not just get kicked out, you know, when the park closes, but actually spend the night. Like who wouldn't want to spend the night in the Disneyland Dream Suite every night? So,
definitely.
Kidding. It's okay. I'll be the only weekly tier without an answer. Make sure you send your questions to Producer James or Producer Vern at trivia@doweekly.net.
Welcome back to Trivia Land. How do you feel about how you did tonight?
Not great.
Not great.
No?
Not at all.
Especially since I couldn't remember Michael Eisner's name and was going with a Bob instead. That was not good.
Well, you know, I'm looking at your score column and I am seeing green. So that's a good something. Thing. I like it when I can see green for you. So well, all right. let's find out how you did officially. So your first regular round question, falling down my rabbit hole. Superstar Limo was the first dark ride in Disney California Adventure, and after receiving terrible reviews, it was the first ride in DCA to permanently close. What dates, month, and year was this attraction open? You both got half a point for knowing that it opened in February of 2001.
Woo!
Tag said that it closed in March of 2002, and Teresa said it closed in February of 2003. The correct closing date was January of 2002. This ride was not open for an entire year.
Look at that.
Those aforementioned terrible reviews include the Boston Globe saying the sets are on par with college theater constructions.
Wow.
The New York Times said probably the schlockiest attraction in the new park.
What does schlockiest mean?
Chintzy, poorly put together. Longview Daily News. They should change the name of this ride from Superstar Limo to It's a Shill World.
Oh, wow.
The space would be better devoted to something more entertaining, such as animatronic dentist doing root canals on all the Imagineers who came up with the idea.
Do you want to know what's really interesting about this? Is we talk about this later. They changed it. It was only the thing was not even open an entire year, and it was changed.
Yep.
You know what I mean? Like, they had a major refurb, and it was only, wow. I really thought it was, I knew it wasn't forever, like, super long, but I really thought it was a little bit longer. Especially now seeing, because we just pulled up, it looks like Mike and Sully to the Rescue opened in 2006. So it sat for a long time.
Yeah. Anyway.
Wow. Very interesting.
Yeah.
Your second regular round question as we're falling into this rabbit hole. The original concept was that riders were celebrities being chauffeured around and chased by paparazzi. At the beginning and end of the ride, a video starring then CEO Blank welcomed the riders to the attraction and bid them farewell. You both getting that correct with Michael Eisner being the CEO in 2001.
Woo!
No high five? All right.
Good job.
Good job, you two. Your third regular round question. After the death of Princess Diana while being chased by paparazzi, it was deemed poor taste to have an attraction based on being chased by paparazzi. The ride was changed to feature celebrities in a ride through Hollywood. Can you name the featured celebrities? You gave me Drew Carey, Whoopi Goldberg, and Jennifer Aniston. And Andy in the chat also threw in Jackie Chan, Tim Allen, and Cindy Crawford. The correct ones I was looking for were Joan Rivers, Regis Philbin, Melanie Griffith, Antonio Banderas, Cindy Crawford, Tim Allen, Jackie Chan, Drew Carey, Cher, and Whoopi Goldberg.
Dang, no Jennifer Aniston.
I kind of wish that I would have seen this.
I wish I could have experienced this just
for
the experience.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to start searching around, see if I can find any ride-through videos.
Well,
there's got to be one in existence.
Go, where was it? We were looking at this Yesterland article, and I had to like try not to laugh out loud while Vern was talking because they have a now showing you the story of you, like billboard that was a photo, apparently a photo in this attraction. Yeah. The person in the third row here is filming, which I think is hilarious because, this was taken in like 2001, maybe 2002.
Right.
And there was already somebody vlogging.
So we need to find that person and find
their
upload.
A video does exist. We have photographic evidence that somebody took at least one video. Oh, they're all over the place on YouTube. I really need to watch one of these.
Yeah.
I'm just so curious about this.
Oh, look, there's even a whole Defunctland episode about Superstar Limo that, how long is this run? 20 minutes long. You can get a whole history of it.
I'm very curious about this.
Well, I know Teresa's going to go down a rabbit hole now after the show.
Mm-hmm.
And your fourth and final regular round question in my rabbit hole tonight. After closing the attraction, a few re-theme ideas were tossed around, trying to keep close to the original idea. Do you know the top two contenders? Both of you giving an emphatic no, you had no idea. The answers that I was looking for were Goofy's Superstar Limo.
Okay.
Retheming it with the classic Disney characters.
Oh.
Later would make its way to Sky School.
Yep.
Yep.
Yeah, but it would have, so instead of having like real people as celebrities, it would have had like Mickey and Minnie and maybe stuff yeah. in yeah. it. Interesting.
And the other top contender, Miss Piggy's Superstar Limo. Featuring the Muppets.
That would have been cute.
Actually, I would have been okay with that. Because wasn't Muppet Vision was back there. I never got to experience. Mm-hmm. I don't remember experiencing Muppet Vision in Disneyland Resort. Definitely, yes, in Disney World. But I don't know if I ever got to do it in land. I don't think I did. But it was back in that same area, so that would have worked.
Yep.
And your bonus question tonight. Which ride replaced Superstar Limo and still functions in that space to this day?
We got a point for
this. Was
one.
Very nice.
Also,
of
incidentally,
you.
Still using the same cars, just reskinned.
Yep. Well, and some of the animatronic figures supposedly are reskinned celebrities that are now the like 2319 people.
Yeah, I'm glad that they did that.
This, what is it? The C.
You, of course, got that answer correct with Monsters, Inc. Mike and Sully to the rescue.
Woohoo!
So what did we end up with per points between the two of us?
You each got 2.5 points.
Oh, that's not terrible.
With half a point for the years that it was open, or the months, 2 years that it was open, and getting Michael Eisner, and getting Monsters, Inc., Mike and Sully to the rescue.
Woo!
Yep. Not too terrible.
Yep.
I want to share, Shannon in the chat says, when a friend of ours came back from DCA, he gave my mom a DCA map for us to look at and until we could go. He legit wrote sucks next to the ride on the map.
I wish I could have experienced this just because.
Well, listeners, how do you think they did? How did you do listening at home? If you've got a suggestion for a rabbit hole that I should follow down sometime, feel free to send that in to trivia@dlweekly.net.
We will be back next week with more Disneyland news and information.
Until then, go out and enjoy the parks.
Please remain seated until the podcast comes to a complete stop and the doors have opened. Then collect your belongings, watch your head, and step carefully from the episode. On behalf of all of our crew, thanks for traveling with us. And we hope you have a happy and memorable visit here at DL Weekly.
Save big money now at Menards. Mastercraft has been making great doors inside and out for over 50 years. Choose from the best in-stock selection of doors ready to take home today. Or design your door your way in-store or on Menards.com. Save big on Mastercraft doors at Menards, America's number one home improvement retailer for customer satisfaction, according to J.D. Power. For J.D. Power 2024 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards.
Save big.